Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. It's March 21st, 2013. And we're going to take up Senator Newman's bill, Senate File 370, is our first item on the agenda. We're going to be very closely focused in only on the provisions that draw the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So we will not be taking testimony at all on the broader questions of assisted reproduction or moral implications or anything like that. Those are policy questions for a different committee with a different jurisdiction. So we have just a few specific provisions, sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, as I understand it, that draw the, is that right?
The whole bill.
The whole bill? Okay, well, we're just going to be focusing on the specific questions relating to the bill itself and not any broader policy questions. So, Senator Newman, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I may, you should have in your packets an A1 amendment. If I could request that someone move that amendment for me to put the bill in the position that I would like to have it.
Senator, is this your first committee? Looks like it. All right.
It is, Mr.
This
Chairman.
This is an author's amendment. So Senator Limmer will move the A1 amendment. All those in say A1?
Is that it?
Got handed to me. Something else.
Another bill.
Different bill. Okay, all those in favor of the author's amendment, A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 370 is a bill that, in my mind, involves access to the courts, access to the judicial system. It is a bill that was brought to me by the Minnesota State Bar Association. And what it does is allow intended parents or an intended parent in a surrogacy situation to be involved in the case involving parentage and who is going to and what are the responsibilities of the parents insofar as the child is concerned. I will tell you, members, that this bill does not involve anything involving pre-birth. It is a bill that only deals with post-birth. I will tell you that our current statute and the standard in Minnesota involves a test of what is in the best interest of the child, and this bill does not change this. The only issue insofar as this bill is concerned is whether an intended parent without genetic connection to the child has standing to be involved in the parentage suit that goes in front of a judge. And because our current statute in Chapter 257 is, frankly, is simply outdated. The medical science has now gone past where this particular statute is. That statute was adopted, I believe, in 1982. And what I am attempting to do with this bill is bring the statute up to date. So with that introduction, I am going to allow Mr. Snyder to identify himself, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and have him visit with you about this. And then at the end, I would just like a minute or two to wrap up, if I may.
Thank you. Senator Newman, we're going to give 10 minutes for testimony on each side of the bill. I'm going to try to keep it strictly focused so we can keep our agenda moving forward. So we'll keep track of time, and just so you can time. Did you have, was Mr. Dobson going to testify as well in favor of the bill? Was that one of your testifiers, Senator Newman?
It is not, Mr. Chairman. I have only Mr. Snyder here with me.
Okay. Mr. Snyder, if you could confine it to about 5 minutes, and we'll give Mr. Dobson 5 minutes as well, and then We'll give the same total amount of time to the other side. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I am Stephen Snyder. I am the immediate past chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section. I'm a member of their legislative committee. I'm also the chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee, in which capacity I lead attorneys across the nation and internationally in issues related to assisted reproduction. I'm also an attorney that has practiced law in this area for more than 20 years, so I have a deep understanding of the participants involved and the issues created by this new form of family building. This statute is best exemplified by a situation that I currently have in my office for one of my clients. So first, let me frame for you how surrogacy occurs. When a heterosexual couple wants to procreate and the woman has issues so that her uterus is not suitable to carry the pregnancy, for example, she may have Rokitansky syndrome, which means she was born without a uterus, but with her ovaries. She may have had adolescent cancer and had a hysterectomy or had her uterus and other part organs removed. So in those situations, when a couple can have their own child genetically related to at least one of them, they need the cooperation and support of another person to replace that missing reproductive component, and therefore that's how surrogacy arises. This bill is not about that process, but about a judiciary gap that that process creates. So when you have a husband who provides his sperm and his wife cannot provide the egg, so they use an anonymous egg donor and they create an embryo, and they transfer that embryo into the uterus of their chosen gestational carrier, the presumptions of paternity and maternity in Minnesota give the carrier or the surrogate a parental presumption. In other words, she can go into court and say, I want to be declared the legal parent of this child. Her husband has a presumption. The intended father who provided the genetics has a presumption. The anonymous egg donor based on genetic relationship has a presumption. And the only person in this scenario who does not have a presumption of parentage, which means she does not have standing to assert her claim to parentage over this child, is the intended mother who has not provided the egg and has not given birth. So the circumstance that has occurred in this case in my office is I had this wonderful couple who had been married for many years and had been trying to have a child for 10 years. The wife could not provide the egg, nor could she carry the pregnancy. So her husband provided the sperm. They used an anonymous donor, and a good friend of their family carried the pregnancy. That person is currently pregnant with twins and is due to deliver next week. Early in the pregnancy, when the surrogate contacted the parents to say she was pregnant with twins, which was great news for them, that occurred on a Friday. The following Saturday, one day after getting the news, the wife walked into the kitchen and found her husband dead on the kitchen floor. So the only person in her family who had a parental presumption in relationship to this child that she intended to create, that she intended to raise, and that she intended to mother was her husband, and he's gone. So as this case currently stands, she has no standing to go into court to initiate a legal proceeding and ask the court for the result that both she and her carrier want, which is for her to be established the legal parent. Because this gap exists, because of the medical procedures being used, we are now violating our due process standard in our judicial system for a very small, very select group of citizens who definitely have an interest in who becomes the parent of this child, but do not have access to the courts or standing to assert their claim. If we add this presumption, the same standard of best interests of the child prevails in all cases. The judge determines who is and who is not the parent. The judge can determine if there's a contest that the surrogate is the parent if that's in the best interest of the child. It does not preclude that determination. But the judge will also have all interested parties before him or her in order to make the right decision, so that if the best interest of the child does lie within the intent of the parties in creating parentage in a non-genetic, non-birth intended mother, the court can do that. This is not an outcome determinative bill. It is not a bill that affects any rights or circumstances before the birth of the child. It simply allows the court to have all the parties before it that are interested in the process and to make the decision that is truly in the child's best interest.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Are there any questions for Mr. Snyder at this time? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, would there be standing in any other state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, this is an issue that has been dealt with primarily in much broader legislation intended to facilitate or discourage surrogacy, and that's not what we have here. So we do not currently have a bill or a presumption like this in any other state at this time.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that answered my question. You gave an instance where there's a gap, where someone couldn't find standing here in Minnesota, and I'm wondering if that same individual could have standing in a different state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I apologize if I didn't understand your question. No, yes, this exists in any state in which surrogacy is going on, and it's going on all across the country. So this situation can arise elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, I still didn't get an answer to my question. You gave an example mm-hmm. of a woman that couldn't have standing here in Minnesota to sue on a relationship with a surrogate.
Correct.
And the carrier. And I'm wondering, she can't sue in Minnesota is what you're telling me. Can she sue in that case in some other state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, again, I apologize for not understanding. No, she doesn't. No other state has jurisdiction over this case.
That's
so jurisdiction and venue is only in Minnesota, and she can't go elsewhere.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
So if she doesn't have a lawsuit here in Minnesota by virtue of a law change that we would accomplish in this bill, she could have a lawsuit nowhere in the country.
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that is correct.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Dobson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dobson had indicated to me that he whispered in my ear that he would not be testifying on the bill, so we can proceed.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So why don't we just move on then to those who've signed up to testify in opposition to the bill. I have Tom Pritchard, and Tanya Prashad, Kathleen Sloan, and Greg Troy. Would you come on forward, Mr. Pritchard? And go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of Minnesota Family Council, and we are speaking in opposition to this bill. It's argued that this bill merely allows all the parties to an agreement to have their day in court, gives them standing, allows the court to decide the best interests of the child. In fact, this bill is extremely far-reaching. It not only undermines the principle of the best interests of the child, but also gives legal effect to agreements which aren't enforceable under state law. Surrogacy agreements attempt to override the statutory provision stating that the birth mother is the mother of the child she gives birth to. This bill would not be before you if the parties to a surrogacy agreement could force a surrogate mother to hand over the baby she's carrying. Surrogate attorneys know they can't enforce these surrogacy agreements. That's why they're pushing this bill, to get the law changed regarding the presumption of who's the father and the mother under a surrogacy agreement and who has legal standing to sue for custody of the child. This bill is a backdoor, major first step toward giving full legal recognition to written surrogacy agreements, not a minor tweaking of the law. This bill is the worst of all possible worlds. It allows surrogacy attorneys and brokers to enter into contracts with women without any safeguards for the surrogate women or babies involved. Unlike adoption, there are no background checks, financial, psychological, criminal, of the contracting persons to a surrogacy agreement. The rights of the birth mother aren't protected. This bill is a surrogate attorney's dream. Under this bill, all that's necessary is there be a written contract. Could be on the back of a napkin. Could involve multiple persons who would then all have legal standing to go into court to fight the birth mother for custody of the baby she's carried in her womb for 9 months. It could involve a 75-year-old man who wants a baby. And note, under this bill, the signer of a contract need have no biological link to the child, yet could go into court to demand custody of a child biologically linked to the surrogate mother. In conclusion, this bill gives legal effect to efforts to circumvent state law, which treats birth mothers as the mother of the baby, and allows the way, and along the way, it undermines the best interests of the mother and the child. It treats children as commodities and exploits women. For all these reasons, I urge you to vote against this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Tanya
Mr.
Prashad?
Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Pritchard a question? Mr. Pritchard, are you saying that the woman in the example by the other attorney should not have any legal recourse or access to a court?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we believe the birth mother should remain is the mother of the child. And for allowing, in this case, a third-party, ungenetically related person to go in is a major step. And I think it gives legal effect to these surrogacy agreements, which we think are problematic in and of themselves. So we think that this puts surrogates at a disadvantage, for one thing, that most surrogates are low-income women. They lose probably 75% of the time once they get into court. So, you pit them against people with lots of money and attorneys. You're really not doing them a service.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orman.
So you're saying the only way to protect those mothers, it would be to foreclose any judicial standing for any party to bring a lawsuit?
Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we think these agreements are unenforceable, should be unenforceable, that it's ultimately the birth mother decides. And once you open up the door to enforcement of these surrogacy agreements, you bring in all the other issues of commodification of children and all the other things. So, and we think this is a major policy shift because right now you're allowing them to give these agreements legal enforcement ability.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Tanya Prashad. Ms. Prashad, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And I should remind testifiers, please be sure to sign in on the sign-up sheet, which we will get to the testifier table as soon as we can. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tanya Prashad. I'm here because I'm a mother. I have four children. Among these four children is a beautiful 8-year-old little girl named Adeline, a little girl whose foundation of existence was formed upon a signed contract and $7,500. My daughter was taken by her intended parents when she was 5 days old. I'd love to stand here and tell you all the details of how this came to be, but honestly, we don't have time, and really, it's not what's important. I'll suffice to say that the separation was difficult for both of us. She cried, I cried, and anyone that was a witness to any of that can't deny that there's a connection between a mother and a child. Emotions. These are the things that these bills and laws can't touch or change. And thankfully, right now, our laws support and protect the sacred and beautiful relationship. We're here because someone wants to change that. And I'm here to beg you not to. Children shouldn't have to question who their mama is. I'm so thankful that my little girl never had to question that. We're so much more thankful than another little girl, born under similar circumstances in this very state, living right here in Minnesota, that doesn't even know who her mama is. An infant baby who is kept from her mom and left in the care of her intended parents because a contract existed. A mama who pays hundreds of dollars in child support every month and hasn't laid eyes on her daughter for years. My sister was also a surrogate. She was paid $18,500 to give up her biological son, but she didn't want to. She didn't want to. Do you know why she ultimately did? Because her attorney, after learning that she was having second thoughts, this is right here in Minnesota, he came to her apartment roughly 72 hours after she had given birth, the time when hormones are raging. And can you imagine her grief after just leaving the hospital without her son? But he came, he was there, to remind her of the legal proceedings, the contract, and the money that she was paid to surrender her son. The contract, the money. You've heard some arguments about egg donors and people dying in other extreme cases. Certainly those things need to be addressed. But this piece of legislature doesn't just affect those people. Can you see how like if I look at the specific language, it talks about the birth mother having the right to, that she has custody until a court determines otherwise. And then it says this doesn't apply in contested paternity or maternity if they're, basically if a contract was signed, it could be in a bar or a restaurant or in the backseat of a car like it was in my case. Because that contract existed, then suddenly she's not, that's not the most important thing anymore. And if you look at our adoption laws, it definitely is very much favors the birth mother. After, you know, her biological child is born, she has some time to decide. In this case, it's just the presumption of her being mom is gone. And I know that she can still go to court and fight it, but immediately, right away, in a case where you're, he talked about a lot of people that are doing it don't have a lot of money. You don't have the presumption of being mom. It's going to be a fight no matter what. I see it as being a first phase in what I think will be pretty radical laws that do nothing more than support the commercialization of pregnancy and parentage that turns children into commodities without giving thought or putting weight into what their rights are or should be. Do you think that my child's experiences and rights are any less important because three selfish people decided to put a contract and a price tag on her head? Do you think that she loved me or I loved her any differently? We shouldn't allow the rights of these children to be up for barter. No one should be able to stake claim to a child because they signed a piece of paper or because they were paid a sum of money, which is, as I was talking about before, something that's oftentimes used to pressure them into ultimately doing it. We're talking about kids, children, and I think it just makes them commodities.
Thank you, Ms. Prashad.
Oh, okay.
Senator Goodwin and then Wimmer.
Okay. Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tanya, right?
Yes.
So are you saying that it's okay to take the money from the parents or from an attorney, but then decide you don't want to do it after the money is gone? Or explain that to me, because you say that money shouldn't exclude you from being able to keep your baby after you've done a contract to say that you will give up this child. So is that what you're saying? I don't understand why you would think that. So I need it.
Ms. Prashad.
Senator, no. I'm saying the opposite. I don't think that these contracts should be recognized. I don't think that they should be recognized. Should there be a means for them to... And it's not even saying that people aren't going to do it, because people are going to do it even without this. It's saying that if they do it, the contract is not... I don't think that it should be enforceable. And oftentimes, the money is what's tied up in the contract. That doesn't mean that they couldn't, in a different way, try to get their money back or whatever. I mean, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you have.
And I'm just going to caution that the question here is about access to courts. That's the bill that's before us. It's not a bigger question about whether or not surrogacy contracts ought to be legally enforceable or not. Let's try to keep our conversation focused on that, please. Anything further, Senator Goodwin? Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Prashad.
That's the question.
I'm trying to understand your testimony. And you were a contracted birth mother. Is that correct?
Ms. Prashad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
And at the time of birth, the child was given over to the intended parents.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And so the dispute is you did not want to give up the child at that time?
Under the current law, because I was her birth mother, her natural mother, I was presumed to be the one that had custody. I was presumed to be her mother, so I am legally her mother. We have joint custody of her now. I think that that's how it should be. That's why I think that this bill should not be passed. I think that the natural mother should be presumed. The birth mother should be presumed the mother.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemon.
Ms. Prashad, but wasn't the contract created in order to give the parentage to connect the intended parents with the child that was created by contract? Wasn't that the agreement?
Yes.
So why is there a dispute that if that was the contract, why do you claim parentage?
Ms. Prashad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, basically because I'm her mom. Biologically, I'm her mother. In Minnesota, if you decide prior to giving birth to a child to give the child up for adoption, you have the right after the child is born. You have no idea how you're going to feel, none at all. And to make it's an object that you write in a contract. In the case of adoption, we don't allow that because the mother should be allowed the opportunity after the child is born to know how she's going to feel, to not feel any, to make that decision. I don't think that it should be, in the case of surrogacy, something that somebody should decide ahead of time, that should be, that you should be held to, that you should be forced to because you thought it was a good idea at some point in time inside any old piece of paper, that you should then be required to do it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
Ms. Prashad, did you have legal representation in giving you advice when you signed the contract?
Ms. Prashad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no.
No more questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Prashad.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman, we have two more witnesses to testify on this bill.
Yep, Ms. Prashad.
Senator
Ortman. Ms. Prashad, I appreciate your coming to tell us this about your story. If I hear you right, please correct me if I'm wrong in any way. What you're saying is the mom, even if she enters into an agreement, should be allowed up to and after the birth of the baby to decide that maybe that wasn't the right choice, that the contractual relationship should be able to be reconsidered again once the baby is born because maybe there are some things that have changed in the way the mother is thinking and feeling about giving birth to that child and should still be given the presumption that she is the birth mother even beyond that. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Prashad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, but a little more than that in that I don't think that it should be happening in the first place. I think that you don't know how you're going to feel. And again, I'm talking about a case where she's biologically my child, and I think that this, while it addresses some of the things he talked about, it also encourages and makes, you know, and says okay to that sort of arrangement as well.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Prashad, I agree with you.
Thank you, Ms. Prashad. Kathleen Sloan. Ms. Sloan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I've traveled from Connecticut here today, and actually, as soon as this is over, I have to hurry to the airport to catch a plane. I was in Detroit yesterday. I don't know if it's Tuesday. It must be Belgium. But this was very, very important when I learned about this bill, and so paid $1,200 for my plane ticket switch to come here. So I hope that I'll be able to present my testimony.
Ms. Sloan, we have limited time today. I'm sorry but I'm going to ask you to focus your time in on the substance of the bill only, please. And we only just have a few minutes for you to present your testimony, just like everyone else.
Okay, sure. My name is Kathleen Sloan, and I'm a women's rights advocate. I'm a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Women, or NOW, the largest feminist activist organization in the United States. I also represent the organization at the United Nations. For the last 6 years, I've worked on issues related to third-party reproduction. As program director of the Council for Responsible Genetics, I developed extensive programming in the area of women in biotechnology. I am co-author of a call for an international declaration on global reproductive trafficking and its violations of human rights. I have written extensively and traveled around the country speaking at the U.S. Capitol, state legislatures, and universities against exploitation and commodification of women through commercial surrogacy and egg trafficking. I have traveled to Minnesota from Connecticut to testify against SF 370 because it would give legal effect to surrogacy agreements in Minnesota, and essentially it's a second precedent that's being set that essentially opens the door and allows for commercial surrogacy in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Sloan, for clarification, are you speaking here on behalf of the National Organization for Women or any of your other involvements?
The National Organization for Women has not taken an official position on surrogacy. It has engaged in a project on the subject matter, but it has not yet taken a formal position. All positions are voted on by the national membership at annual national conferences, and so we will be addressing this at our conference in July.
So you're speaking today only in your personal capacity?
That is correct.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I urge you to oppose this legislation because surrogacy exploits and commodifies women and poses serious risks to their health. Specifically, this bill seeks to deny the gestational mother of the child any rights to the child who would not exist but for her. And essentially, the rest of my testimony was speaking on the whole issue of surrogacy. And I wasn't aware that for this particular hearing, it was only to be focused on this particular bill.
Thank you, Ms. Sloan. I'm sorry you didn't understand that when you decided to come here, but I appreciate you focusing on the issue that's before this committee. Are there any questions for Ms. Sloan? All right. Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. Greg Troy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gregory Troy. I'm a licensed attorney practicing in the area of adoption. Since 1990, I've been following the issue of adoption law changes as codified under Minnesota Statute 259. In 1994, the attorneys, principally two attorneys in Hennepin County, attempted to circumvent adoptions through agencies by giving contractual powers to adoptive couples at the stake of birth moms. And this legislature at that time said, no, we're not going to allow that. We're going to follow the best interest of the child by incorporating what they were doing, which was independent adoptions, into Minnesota Statute 259.471. The problem that's presented by Mr. Schneider's bill is a problem that's already got a solution. It's called intervention. Under Minnesota Rules of Court 127, his clients have the right to intervene, and they have a right to intervene because they're a member of a contract, and the courts at this point have no guidance from this body as to whether or not these are legal or not. So it's left to the deference of a court. And when you shift this power by adding this particular presumption to the intended parents, you shift the power away from adoption agencies and the birth mom. And when you do that, you shift the natural caregiving of a birth mom for the best interest of the child and the oversight that the Department of Human Services has been regulating with adoption agencies over to IVF clinics. And so you will see the demise of independent adoptions and adoptions done by agencies, because you will make my clients, when they ask me which is easier, I'll say, if you're an attended parent, it's much easier to go through surrogacy. And as a result of that, you will have a number of children that are going to be waiting for adoption in Minnesota. So you've got an unfunded mandate going on here with the other 87 counties who are going to wonder what they're doing with all these unintended pregnancies that were otherwise being adopted by children, by parents who are turning to surrogacy because it's easier, they have much more power, they might get health care coverage, because IVF is going to say, let's push it through your insurance. And as a result, you're going to have children waiting to be adopted. You've got a series of unintended consequences. And I refer you to Samuel Butler's book, Nowhere Backwards, in which he states we've got this dystopia where children in this particular case aren't going to be adopted. In his case, it was the sick were being put in prison and the criminals were being put in hospitals. And I would suggest you've got a number of unintended consequences that are going to take place in the next several years because you haven't codified this under the best interest of the child. You have no adoption agency regulation. You've got IVF clinics that are, by and large, for-profit entities, whereas we regulate adoption agencies to be nonprofit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Troy. Any questions for Mr. Troy? Thank you for your testimony. Be sure to sign in. And Ms. Sloan, I don't know if you signed into the testifier sheet. Please do so before you leave here. Senator Newman, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to be very brief because I know you're on a deadline. But there's a couple things that I want to bring you back to the purpose of the bill. And the purpose of the bill is standing to get into our judicial system in the state of Minnesota. All of the opponents have come up and testified, and what they're talking about is whether or not surrogacy is a good or a bad idea. That's not the purpose of this bill. I will tell you very candidly that I have significant reservations regarding the wisdom of surrogacy. But I also have a very strong belief that people have a right to access to our judicial system whether or not we agree with their cause of action. And what has happened in this field is there is a Court of Appeals case out there. Mr. Snyder can cite it for you. I can't. But there's a Court of Appeals case that says the non-genetically linked intended parent does not have standing to get into court and assert that right. And that's what this bill is trying to fix, is to allow access to our judicial system. I think it's a very basic constitutional right. The assertion by Mr. Troy that the individuals that have a right, that I believe should have a right to get into court, can get there by right of intervention, I believe he is incorrect. There is a court rule that allows for intervention, but in this case, a court of appeals has said that the individual does not have standing. So even if you move to intervene, it's going to be denied, in my opinion. I would simply ask members, please get back to the purpose of the bill, and that is very simply to allow someone who was the intended parent the ability to get into court. And very honestly, without that intended parent being a party to the lawsuit, I really don't see how you can possibly get to the underlying issue of what is in the best interest of the child. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Newman, I should have asked if there is anyone else in the room who wanted to be heard on this bill before we conclude this. Is there any discussion from the members of the committee? Senator Lindman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've studied this off and on. Mr. Snyder is a constituent. We've talked often about this issue. It's hard to have a discussion without bringing up the child in this issue. And I can see why those who are concerned about the whole science of gestational surrogacy would get a little queasy or nervous without mentioning the child. After all, you have two parties joining in a contract, and as a result, the product of the contract is another human being. The question that I have is does the unborn child have, are you recognizing the unborn child as having standing as this contract is being created? This contract is unique because it is creating a third entity that I think that's the struggle with the legislature. We're trying to recognize all parties. Usually in a contractual discussion, the parties are obvious. In this case, the third party may not be as obvious for the contractual purpose, but it is an entity that cannot be ignored. So by beginning to create this area of law, are we doing it complete enough to satisfy the concerns that we have from time to time in the legislature?
Senator Newman or Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it is a difficult balance to discuss the best interests of the child versus the procreational constitutional rights of the parents. I procreated. I had sex with my wife. I didn't talk to my wife about our child would come, whether it would come into a good family. I didn't talk or know that I was going to get divorced and my children were going to be the result of a broken home. So the best interest of a child at the time parents are procreating is a difficult thing to attach to and to measure, because these parents are exercising their procreational constitutional right when they initiate the process and the child does not exist. That's a debate for whether we legislatively approve surrogacy, and that's not related to this bill. What I have taken from you in our decades worth of conversations, Senator Limmer, and I thank you, is that the best interests of the child is important as at the earliest moment at which it attaches, which currently under the law is at birth. So I have designed a bill that is wholly governed and centered around the best interests of the child, because that is the standard the judge in a paternity case will apply to determine who should receive custody and legal parental rights. To correct some misstatements, the surrogate is not giving up her presumption. The intended parent is not getting a greater presumption. They're equal, and they're both coexistent until the judge decides which to give effect to, and that's done under the best interests of the child standard. So if the judge says a 75-year-old intended parent is not the better parent compared to a 35-year-old surrogate, the surrogate can be awarded legal parentage, and the father cannot. And Senator Ortman, just so we're clear, a surrogate today, under the existing law, if this goes into effect, has the legal right to assert maternity, contest the contract, and say she wants to keep the child. There have been two cases in Minnesota where that has occurred, and that is the existing law. So your concern, and I agree with you, is that that can happen currently, and what the court will do is apply the best interest standard in determining who can get it. The question is, if I have a surrogate with an egg donor with an intended mother, the surrogate has a presumption, but she's not the genetic mother. The genetic provider has a presumption, but she's not known. The intended mother who started the process, who wanted to procreate with her husband, who has an interest in saying, at least, judge, this was my idea, this is my only opportunity to procreate, should at least be able to appear in front of the court and make her argument. She has no advantage. She has no superior presumption. Right now, she's at a disadvantage because she's locked out of the courts by our out-of-date law. And all we're trying to do is give her access and trust the judges to make the right decisions in the cases they're empowered to do so under the standard that incorporates best interests.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, there's an inherent imbalance of power here. And I don't think that your testimony acknowledges that properly. There's an imbalance of power when the young woman agrees in a contract to take money in exchange, maybe not understanding what that might mean at the day of birth or in the days following birth. But then if the surrogate parents can participate in a lawsuit, and the question is not what does the mother want and the presumption is in her favor, but instead the question is what's in the best interest of the child, that imbalance of power again comes to the forefront. The parents who had the wherewithal to put $25,000 on the table obviously have a better economic situation than the mother who agreed, perhaps under duress, to offer up her services as a surrogate for $25,000. And so if the judge is going to engage in that question, he's going to find the stable family that can come up with that economic money and balance that in the best interest of the child against the mother. And so I'm sorry, I have to agree that whether or not this bill passes, these kinds of contracts shouldn't be enforceable because we have some women that are at a terrible disadvantage here. And so I can't help you, Senator Newman. I'm sorry.
Senator Ortman, let me just suggest legal duress would not apply here because the duress would not have been applied by the person offering the cash. It would be duress from the surrogate mother's own financial circumstances, well, perhaps, and that's not illegally cognizable duress that would invalidate a contract.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't looking for a treatise discussion. I think there's an imbalance of power, and the young lady is likely to take a contract if she needs the contract and won't have a lawyer in either instance.
I would like to finish what I was saying before you respond. That's the procedures in this committee. Senator Ortman, my other point was that there is nothing that undermines the free will of the surrogate mother. She makes the choice. She makes the choice. And as I said, we're not going to get into a large discussion here about whether surrogacy is an appropriate question. That's not the bill before us. Senator Ortman, do you have anything else you'd like to say in regards to this issue?
Mr. Chair, I disagree. I believe it is the issue before us, and that imbalance of power prevails from the start of the relationship all the way through any court proceedings. That young lady is also very unlikely to be able to hire an attorney at any point to represent her legal interests.
All right. Is there any further discussion from members of the committee? Senator Goodwin and then Senator Sherry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what this whole discussion brings about is the fact that this is so unregulated. The issue is that surrogacy is so unregulated. I think something that ought to be done is certainly there should be some kind of, just like there is with adopting a child, some kind of psychological evaluation of the surrogate before they actually before they actually go through the process, and certainly maybe of the parents that are going to be getting that child as well. And it looks like this is just so wide open that it's every single case is wide open for a lawsuit. And I can understand a young woman that, or even a married woman with children that needs the money and thinking she's going to do this and it's all going to be fine, she's going to let go of that child. I can also understand her wanting to keep that child afterwards, but she's already entered into a contract. I don't like the idea that it can be done on the back of a napkin or whatever, that it's not legally worded contract. But at any rate, it shows, I think, that we all need to, in this committee anyway, talk about what we need to do to regulate this a little bit better, regulate this whole process. I don't disagree with Senator Newman's bill at all. I think that one of the parents, if one of the parents has donated their sperm to that child, then they, even whether that parent is dead or alive, that certainly should have been also considered a product of that marriage. So that mother, I can't even imagine how she must feel. Her husband died and then she doesn't get the child that she thought she was getting. So it's a complex, complicated issue. I'm going to support this bill because I do think it's a step in the right direction, but I'm not supporting it as a final solution. I'm thinking that we need to do more work on this, and that's what I would like to do.
Senator Sherman.
May I ask Senator Ortman a question for clarification?
Senator Sherman.
I was trying to make sure I understood what you were saying, and that is about the imbalance of power for the birth mother. But as I understand you were articulating that, that exists under current law as much as it would under the change in this law. That the fact that the birth mother is entering into the contract and under any scenario is less likely to have the resources because they're doing it for resources as the other side of the contract, that they, throughout the whole process, if they want to change their position, is less likely to be able to assert their rights under any circumstances, you're saying that, which I suspect, if that's true, causes you to disagree with the entire process. Is that, am I understanding your position correctly?
Senator
Orban. Mr. Chair and Senator Sherman, I can't stop through this legislation the napkin agreement between the surrogates and the birth mother. I would if I could. That's happening now. But right now, the law, as I understand from the attorneys, these contracts are unenforceable in a court, which means that the woman, the mother, has all the rights. And that's the way I think it should remain until we do something on a broader scale about this, if we're going to do anything at all.
Thank you. Then I would like to have a sense of, is there agreement or disagreement about the ability to enforce the contract?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sherman, yes. There is an unpublished Court of Appeals case in Minnesota captioned In Re Baby A, in which the appellate court said that surrogacy contracts are not void as against public policy, and in which it gave full force and effect to a written contract in a surrogacy agreement, including its choice of law provision applying Illinois law. So they are enforceable according to the courts.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
From what you've just said, it's an unpublished opinion. It's not precedential. And so we don't have law to the contrary of that. That's just one judge in an unpublished opinion. And then he must have said, or the judge must have said, it cannot be cited as precedent, right?
That is
for
correct.
The record, it would have been three judges on the Court of Appeals.
Unpublished.
Unpublished, but still three judges.
Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? Senator Newman.
To that point, I have tried to find case law in Minnesota that would indicate that surrogacy contracts in the state of Minnesota are void as against public policy. I have been unable to find such a case, and consequently, it is simply my conclusion that these contracts are enforceable in Minnesota at the current time. I'm not saying that they're a good idea. I'm saying that I have found nothing to indicate that there is any decision out there that says they are void.
Senator Dietzick.
Consequently, I think they are legal.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer had mentioned that this issue has been around for a while. I have not been over here, so this is a very complicated issue. All of the testimony has been, very, very torn both ways. I feel for the mother. I believe if you sign a contract, I think that there should be access to court. But I think it terrifies me that this could go into trafficking, and it is not regulated like adoptions. So I'm really having a hard time with this one because if you look at just the contract, it's a contract. I do think that this is something that we do need to, no matter what happens here today, and again, I don't know where I'm at, but I do think we need to look forward at this, and rather to go on with surrogacy or not, I think it does need to be regulated. I think this is happening right now, whether we like it or not. There are back-of-the-napkin agreements, and so whoever wants to, if anybody wants to work with me, I would agree to move forward in working with this because I think it does need to be regulated like adoptions and other options because I think you will have trafficking and there probably is already. So thank you for bringing forward the discussion because it's been eye-opening. So thank you and thank you to everybody testifying because I think it's a very heart-wrenching issue. And so thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
We have great researchers, and I was just handed a copy of this Court of Appeals decision, paternity and custody of baby boy. It was 2007, three-judge panel, as you said, Mr. Chair. And the court found that the court erred in enforcing the gestational surrogacy agreement and erred in enforcing Illinois law. So there is no decision recognizing a surrogacy agreement in Minnesota. That's not the case that does it, if you say that it does.
Senator Ortman, what's the name of the case that you're referring to?
Paternity and custody of baby boy.
A?
Baby boy A, excuse me. Yeah, I don't have my glasses on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I tried that case. I argued it to the Court of Appeals. I wrote the brief and I read the opinion, and it does not hold that the trial court erred in enforcing the agreement. What it did is it said the agreement was enforceable and Illinois law was properly applied. So I'm not sure what's on that paper, but I know for a fact that that's what the court held because my client prevailed.
Okay. Members, we have before us Senate File 370. Sounds like we've got a few members willing to work on the bigger issue, the more difficult issue of the appropriateness and regulation of surrogacy contracts in Minnesota. But is there any further discussion on Senate File 370 before the committee now? Is there a motion?
I'll make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 370 be recommended to pass. And as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. Please raise your hands. If all those in favor, raise your hands. All those opposed, raise your hands.
It dies on the title.
Being four in favor and four opposed, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, we're going to adjust the agenda a little bit here. Senate File 934, Senator Wieger. Pick up your bill right now.
Discussion.
Senator Wiegand, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Senate File 934 is a crime prevention consumer protection measure. Thousands of cars are stolen annually in Minnesota. Law enforcement is able to recover most of them. However, hundreds of cars, we don't know how many, are scrapped. This initiative, through county attorneys and other groups, is designed to get better identification before the vehicle does go for scrapping. We have been through the Commerce and Transportation Committee. There's been a number of amendments. And to address the provisions as it relates to the committee, I'd like to go to Ramsey County Attorney John Choi. And we won't have a lot of testimony on the background on the need for the issue, but some of the specific questions you might have on implementation. So,
thank you.
Mr. Choi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. The second engrossment that is before you today is representative of the industry's language as it relates to trying to address this issue, and this addressing this issue about scrapping scrap metal and automobiles is a big one. And with respect to the issues that are before this committee, Mr. Chair, I could try to address them as best I can, or I could respond to the questions that you might have.
Mr. Choi, why don't you address the issues specifically before the committee, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Then do you want me to go section by section that I understand to be the relevant provisions?
Yeah, would I that understand be? There's sections 1, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Okay. Well, section... Mr. Chair, section 1 of the bill is just a clarification. The way that the existing statute exists is that it says that the registrar or the registrar's inspectors may file charges with the county attorney. We felt that that language was kind of cumbersome. The inspectors would be presenting cases to the county attorney. And so we make the change so that it's to make it very clear that if we're talking about who can bring charges, that it's the county attorney. And we also thought that the city attorney should also be able to have that ability. Section 3 of the bill, the affidavit of saleability, this is not something that law enforcement would support. However, this is a part of an ongoing discussion that we're having. And we believe that we will be able to address some of these issues. But I think the premise here is that, and this is probably overall what, from a law enforcement community, what we like about the bill is that this bill is, I guess, embracing the concept that you cannot scrap a vehicle unless you have a title or some other document that would prove that you actually own that document. And what the industry has done is they have tried to develop a way in which for those individuals that don't have title would be able to get an affidavit of saleability from the law enforcement agency. And it says in line 2.13 that the law enforcement agency must execute any request for an affidavit of saleability at the time of request. We do have problems with this provision. We're working with the industry to work out this issue in the House file. This language does not exist, and it's a different concept that we're trying to make happen under law.
Mr. Choi, yeah. What is your perception of what that language means on lines 13 and 14 of page 2? Does it mean the law enforcement agency is simply acting as the notary public, or are they attesting to the existence of certain facts themselves? So it's the agency's imprimatur that is
rendered. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I did not draft this provision, and again, we do not support it, but I don't want to speak for the industry. Maybe Paul Cassidy could speak to it, but I think what they're saying is that the law enforcement agency would be in the role of doing some sort of check and to have some stamp of approval to say that this car is not stolen, and that is something that the police chiefs are not willing to do. And Jim Franklin's here, but I think that we have some concerns about that.
Mr. Cassidy, can you address that question?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard, representing the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries. That specific provision we put together, first of all, just to back up a little bit, this entire intent of this bill is to slow down criminals and hopefully speed up the information flow to law enforcement with regards to scrap metal and scrapped automobiles. This particular provision is our solution to slowing down the criminals, which is if they have a car without a title, they need to go to their local law enforcement agency and somehow prove that they do own the vehicle or have title to it and get that affidavit signed and sign it in terms of that alleging that the facts are true and that they've provided law enforcement, satisfied law enforcement's need for identification and ownership.
Okay, maybe at some point we'll ask for other testimony from law enforcement agencies on that provision anyway. Any questions while we're on this provision from members of the committee? Mr. Choi, why don't you go on to
Sure, and then it was five. Section 4 included in the jurisdiction of this committee, Mr. Chairman?
I believe not.
Five. No, okay, so then the next section would be Section
5.
Five. And under Section 5, those are definitions, and the only change is made in page 3, line 24. And the what is stricken from the statute is the term or motor vehicle parts, and I believe that that was to exclude that situation, if I'm not mistaken. Correct.
Mr. Chairman, in Section 5, the stricken language, that actually now will put salvage yards, which are businesses that sell auto parts, back into the legislation, so they will be under the purview of this statute going forward. They were exempted from this statute when it was created in 2007, approximately 6 years ago. So that they would be now be included back into this regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Section 6,
and then Section 6. Basically lays out the records that must be kept and to what extent and how they would do that. And let me be clear again, from our perspective, from the law enforcement perspective, we think that this should be done through the automated property system, and that is something that is in the House bill. Here it lists how they would do this, but it's not in the automated property system. I believe that there's under line 14 on page 4, there's a statement signed by the seller under penalty of perjury. We would support that. That would be an improvement in the law. And the penalty of perjury, just for the record, it doesn't say this in the language, but we would hope that the intent here that the industry would want is that it would be penalty of perjury pursuant to Minnesota Statute 609.48, which would make it a felony crime. And it's a five-year felony, Mr. Chairman.
Let me ask a question of counsel then. Do we need to specify a statutory reference for the penalty of perjury, or is that implied?
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear some of the background discussion about it, but I believe that would be implied. I don't know that you need to have a specific section.
Is there any other statute that addresses penalties for perjury?
Mr. Chair, I imagine there are quite a few. I don't have not looked at it.
But the actual crime of perjury.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's articulated in 609.48.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So I guess the question, if there's no other statute that makes it a crime to perjure oneself, then that's the only statute that could possibly apply.
That's right.
You probably don't need to specify it. We'll just double check on that.
Right. And then moving on, Mr. Chairman, line 4.33, maybe a technical issue here, but I just want to point it out that I just caught, since we're talking about in the first section, county or city attorneys, it probably might be a good idea to insert the word or city after the word county on line 4.34. It's just something that I just caught right now to make it conform with section 1 of the second engrossment.
Is there any discussion on that suggestion, or Mr. Cassidy, does that seem acceptable to you?
Absolutely.
Senator Hall, will you move the amendment?
Chair.
Senator Hall moves that line 4.34 after county, insert or city. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Mr. Choi?
And then moving on, Mr. Chairman, was Section 7 included in the jurisdiction of this committee?
Yes.
The language is on 5.17. This language would put the onus on law enforcement agencies. I think it is important that there is a partnership, that both sides are sharing this information. But again, I just want to be very clear from the law enforcement perspective that I think that the automated property system is what is going to achieve that, and not putting the burden onto the law enforcement agencies only. I don't know, Paul, if you want to address that provision between 5.17 and 5.20.
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Cassidy.
That provision in particular was put in here, again, looking back at the 2007 law in which the BCA was put in charge of a criminal alert network in which the industry was using annual registration fees to fund it. That criminal alert network was meant to, for the BCA to post items that they were aware of, stolen items, so that the industry could go to that website, look to see what items law enforcement is looking for, and hopefully coordinate with law enforcement to catch the criminals that have stolen particular items. It hasn't been particularly effective. This is really just saying that they have to post items to that website within 24 hours of notice.
All right. Any discussion or questions about that provision?
And Mr. Chairman, moving on to Section 8, with respect to the existing law, with respect to investigative holds and property held by law enforcement, I think these are kind of technical changes, and we're improving the existing statute. I think putting a little bit more due process in, actually, quite frankly, we're reducing the time from 90 days to 30 days from the time that we have to how long that investigative hold can be in place. We also make some technical, what I would characterize as technical changes to, instead of using the word seizure or seize, we are using confiscation or confiscate. But again, this provision is really for the protection of victims who have had their cars stolen. And so if we believe we have probable cause to believe that is the case, then this section in the existing statute would kind of outline how law enforcement would go about doing that, and I think we've made some improvements as it relates to how this process would work, and as evidenced by the fact that it's in this particular engrossment, because this is reflective of what the industry would request.
Mr. Choi, on lines 6.7 and 6.9, the words seized and seize appeared. Would you wish to have those also converted to the appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would make the bill consistent, that section consistent.
So Senator Hall will move that line 6.7 delete the word seized and replace it with the word confiscated. And line 6.9, delete the word seize and insert in its place confiscate. Make sense, Mr. Choi?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Is there any further discussion from the committee? Senator Wieger, is there anyone else that you know of that wish to testify?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Franklin, did you want to be heard on this matter, or are you
conservative?
Waving me off? Okay.
And Mr. Chair, members, as disclosed, you know, the law enforcement, prosecutors, and the industry, they want to go after the criminal and to do it in a fair process. There's work to be done. They're talking. There's going to be changes, but we want to facilitate that discussion and not see it unduly held up as it has in previous years. So there's an understanding that we're going to continue working together, and we'll hopefully reach a compromise on some of the other issues addressed earlier.
Senator Wieger, I for one have some concern about Section 3. The law enforcement agency is in effect being asked to certify that a vehicle has not been stolen. stolen, and that's a little awkward position for the law enforcement agency in. And I can conceive of some liability on their part if they were erroneous in some way, if someone didn't maintain records properly or something like that. So I trust you'll work on that.
It's noted. Thank you.
Anyone else have similar concerns or wish to express any other concerns about the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have heard from numerous people, and but my understanding is everybody is working together to move this forward and find a resolution that everybody can agree with, and so I appreciate that, and so I'm supporting it, understanding that. Thank you.
Would you like to move the bill?
I will move Senate File 934.
Senator Dudzik moves that Senate File 934 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on Finance.
I believe it's to the floor.
Now I'm getting people waving.
Mr. Chair.
I've gotten different notes now. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, 24 hours ago it would have gone to Finance, but last night they took out the provision on the auto theft prevention account, and they took out a study and report. It was deleted last night in transportation. And
correct.
So I believe this can proceed directly to the floor.
Senator Weaver, that's your understanding now as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You're perfectly happy to accept that?
Yeah.
Well, not perfectly, but I'm satisfied.
All right, so Senator Dudzik's motion is that Senate File 934 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Weaver.
And thank you and to the committee for all the hard work you're putting in this session.
All right, we'll revert back to the agenda in its original order. Senate File 1450. Senator Marty, are you present? I don't see Senator Marty rushing.
I texted him. I thought he was on his way down.
Okay, there's Senator Marty in the nick of time. All those in favor? No. Okay. Roll call.
Mr. Chair, last night I walked in on the nurses' bill hearing, and I was expecting a two-hour debate, and they had said the bill was started about 2 minutes early. I walked down in the chairs. All those in favor? And Senator Sharon was pleased that there was no opposition, and she, hallelujah, and I'm walking in, and what's going on in here? I don't know what she did, but I'm glad to have a chance to be here.
Because you had arrived, Senator Martin.
Yeah, that was it. Was
acceleration.
I'm
that's
sure
right,
that's
Senator Lads. It was a greeting for Senator Marty. Hallelujah.
I was glad to finish before I got there.
Senate File 1450. Senator
Mr. Chair, this is a small bill. Came to us from Ramsey County, and it relates to child support enforcement services discontinuation. And there are a handful of cases, a handful meaning I think 18,000 statewide, but out of 1,800 statewide, out of 240-some-thousand child support cases that the county believes are not worth pursuing anymore. It's after a child is grown, and either the arrearage is under $500 and they haven't been able to collect, or if it's over $500, it's considered unenforceable because there have been no collections in 3 years and all the remedies they're allowed, and we've given them many of them, haven't worked, and the obligor has no known assets or job or anything like that. So in effect, they feel they have no chance to collect the money. And this would give them the ability, with giving notice to both the obligor and obligee, that they're going to close the case. This does not forgive the debt. So if the obligor at some point would have a chance to pay it back, then in effect they can open up the case again. But it's just simply a matter of keeping many, many cases open for years that are ending up costing them money for something that they have no real chance of collecting. And they did come in with there is an A2 amendment. I believe this was based, the House wanted to make sure that they give notice, clear notice to the obligee so that that individual knows that if they find the obligor has some money because the debt has not been forgiven, that they have the ability to notify them and so on. And the House wanted to make sure it was more thorough notice, so we're giving them two separate mailed notices to the obligee. And with that, I have Mr. Mark Ponsole from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, who can speak to the bill if you want. I will tell you that I just heard a few minutes before we came here that the Department of Human Services has no objection to the bill, but there will be a fiscal note, not because they're losing child support collections, but because they have to change their computers, and apparently that's a big enough hassle that it will require a fiscal note. But the department does not have any objection to it by any means. And with that, I'll...
Senator Marty, this is your first stop for the bill. Apparently not the last stop in the committee.
Unfortunately.
Route here, but being that it's your first committee, there's an author's amendment, A2. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Mr. Ponsole, do you have anything to add?
Senator Latz, other than to say my name is Mark J. Ponsole, P-O-N-S-O-L-L-E. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and the counties are the primary collection vehicle for child support in Minnesota, which is why we've asked Senator Marty to carry the bill. I think Senator Marty has outlined the bill very, very well, so I just stand for any questions the committee has.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Ponsole? Senator Dietzig.
I'll talk quick because I know we don't want to be here all day. But and it doesn't really get to the – it gets before the bill. But do you do any when you're in these cases and the usually the father does not have money, do you guys do any job training to try to get him into a job? And I'm assuming all of that done is long before this, and there has been stuff and trying to get them to get educated and get a job, and it just for whatever reason doesn't work. And so it's not a quick decision that you come to this, and I understand the cost of the attorneys or the counties to keep doing it. I'm just, are we just go through this some quickly, some of the steps before the decision is made?
Mr. Ponsole.
Senator Litz, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dietzig, we go through a real exhaustive process. We don't actually provide job training services, but we collaborate with folks like the Father Project, and there's several other groups that we work with to help people who don't have jobs get jobs. The whole goal is to have children taken care of, so we recognize that difficulty. Also, there's a number of tools we have that the legislature has authorized us to do before we get anywhere near the idea of determining cases uncollectible.
Any further questions? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure, I didn't remember hearing this, but when you close a case, that is not a permanent close, and if situations do change, I assume there's a process to reopen.
Mr. Ponsole.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, that's exactly correct. Our goal is to collect child support for children, so if we learn any information, either from the other parent or anyone, we will open the case and proceed.
Senator Hall, the last sentence, lines 1.19 to 2.2 on the A2 amendment specifically addresses your concern.
Thanks.
Any further questions or discussion on this matter? Is there anyone in the audience wish to be heard? Senator Sharon then moves that Senate file 1450 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of the fastest visits I've had in Judiciary Committee in the last several years.
Where's Senator
Mr.
Limmer?
Chair? You're no longer.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask
you.
You're
no longer on it, Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, in terms of how long debates take sometimes, I figured out the reason we've been having such long debates this year. Senator Eakin came from the House because they talked too long over there. He comes over here. Now we have too long of conversations. Maybe he talks. As one of the quietest people here, I was going to say we sometimes all go on a long time on things. But I appreciate the debate this committee always gives my bills, and thank you today.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I interrupted your departure. I caused you to sit back down. I apologize. All right, Senate File 614, Senator Nino.
Thank
Senator Nina, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not very often I end up sitting in front of the Judiciary Committee. I can count probably on two fingers the number of times I've had a bill come through here. Just not my typically my domain as far as legislation is concerned.
Hope to make this experience pleasant for you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 614 was a request that came to me, I believe, actually from the gentleman to my right, the representative from the Isani County Attorney's Office. It's supported by any number of organizations. It was precipitated by an event, and I forget the year, 2007 or 8 or 2009. You might recall there was a lot of media coverage on it. It was the Carlos Avery fire. There were over 1,500 acres that burned in that. Ultimately, it was determined to be an act of arson. There was a firefighter who I guess technically didn't plead guilty. I think it was an Albert plea, is that the term? You lawyers would know what that plea is. He didn't technically plead guilty, but took the penalties.
Alford plea,
there you go. This is the non-lawyer here in the Judiciary Committee, Mr. Chair.
Senator, you know.
I won't give you all the details. I will let Mr. Binek here to my right go into that a little bit more and tell you the purpose and intent of this legislation.
Is Mr. Binek a lawyer?
I am, Your Honor.
Oh, then you're welcome to the committee. See, us lawyers on the committee are outnumbered anyway, as members on the committee. So before we do that, let's address the author's amendment. Senator Nienau, this is your first committee. You have the A3 amendment, I understand. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. There's a couple of technical wording changes, but the substance of the amendment is to bring into alignment some changes that were made in the other body, as well as to garner support from organizations that the testifier will mention.
Thank you. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Mr. Bina, did I pronounce that right?
That's correct, yes.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Bienick, and I'm an assistant Isani County attorney here to testify in support of Senate File 614. This bill increases the criminal penalties in the wildfire arson statute, which is Minnesota Statute 609.5641. And those penalties would be increased where this arson fire threatens buildings or dwellings, where a certain number of acres are burned, where crops are burned to a certain value, and also where someone suffers demonstrable bodily harm. My idea for this bill came out of what has become known as the Carlos South Fire of April 2009, which burned 2,637 acres. And this wildfire was started by arson. This was the arson that was alluded to by Senator Nienau that was started by a firefighter. I am a firefighter with my local community of Hugo, and I did also respond to that fire. I followed it in the news, and I was kind of struck at the kind of minimal penalty that this arsonist faced, given the enormous response it took from firefighters. This fire required 120 apparatus from the 31 departments of Washington and Anoka counties, and the personnel to go along with them. And all but 12 of these apparatus were committed somewhere on the fire. Additionally, the DNR sent a helicopter, as well as the National Guard sent a helicopter. There were 150 homes that were threatened by that fire, and just about that number of evacuations that needed to be ordered. So I started thinking about, what could be done better with this statute, and I began kind of a redraft of the statute to increase those criminal penalties. I've been in contact with other organizations that are interested in this area, and what I have provided to Senator Nienau is the result of some of those discussions. And I can report that this bill is supported by the MCAA, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. It's also supported by the Minnesota Chapter of Arson Investigators, the Minnesota Fire Departments Association, the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association. I've also been in contact with the Minnesota DNR and the Minnesota State Fire Marshal's Office, and I can report that they do not object to the bill. It sounds like there's a little more process that they have to go through to get, where they can say, or I could sit here and say that they support the bill. But I can report that they do not object to the bill. And I ask for your support of Senate File 614.
Thank you, Mr. Bienick. John Kingery is on our list of testifiers from the County Attorneys Association. Mr. Kingery, are you present? Do you wish to be heard?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kingery was a possibility. He was going to be at the Capitol, but don't know if he could be here today in this room.
Mr. Bienick has identified that the County Attorneys Association does support the bill.
That's correct.
Is there anyone else in the room that would like to be heard on this bill? Any questions or discussion from members of the committee? We're creating some substantial felonies here, so we better make sure we know what we're doing. Senator Goodwin.
I haven't seen the whole bill, but this wouldn't... This would have to be intentional, right? It wouldn't be, you know, intentionally trying to cause trouble, because I'm just thinking about farmers that do controlled burns, or, you know, need to burn a certain part of their property or whatever, for whatever reasons they need to do it for. So, you know, to get rid of weeds, or sometimes I've seen that on the way up to Pine City, that those kind of controlled burns have gone on. So just want to make sure we're not going to be prosecuting people that aren't intentionally trying to cause damage.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
absolutely. We are amending some new language into a section of law, but the existing language in law does specify that it has to be intentionally set to burn out of control.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions or discussion? Is there a motion?
Motion.
Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 614, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Amino.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for your time.
Hope your experience was pleasant. Welcome back any other time.
It was much shorter than I hear many others have in this community.
Everybody gets warned.
I move to reconsider.
I told you.
We don't want any rumors circulating.
Getting soft here.
Yeah.
Senator Goodwin, Senate File 443. You know, let me ask Senator Goodwin first. If Senator Eaton is present, since she's not on the committee.
She is. She's not.
Senator Goodwin, do you have any objection if we take the bill up first? Just as a courtesy to those who aren't on the committee, do you mind? I don't know yet. Let's see. Out in the past. You've got the amount.
Do you have any problem with this one?
Who made it? Do you remember who made the motion?
Yeah.
Picked up.
I don't know. Good question.
Sure.
I usually support these things, but are we getting...
Senator Eaton will take up Senate File 1297. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out what the part is that affects this committee.
Well, let's take a look.
There's a summary of the issues.
Members, in your packets, there's a memorandum from Senate Counsel identifying a whole list of sections that come within this committee's jurisdiction. So, Senator Eaton, I can tell you what they are if you like, or we get a copy of the memo to you as well.
I think I have them, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Why don't we focus on those provisions and step us through?
Okay, Mr. Chair, the first one would be Article 1, Section 1.
Before you do that, why don't you just give us a 30-second overview on the goals and intent of the overall bill? Just so we can put these specific provisions into context.
Mr. Chair, this is essentially a department bill, and I'm going to allow them to explain it.
Okay. Thank you. Please identify yourself, sir.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Reuter, and I am the Director of Operations Support for State-Operated Services. This is a department bill. It is considered, it bridges two areas of our department, the Chemical and Mental Health Administration, as well as State Operated Services. Article 1 is provisions related to our Children's Mental Health Division and changes associated with that. excluding Section 1 of Article 1. Section 1 of Article 1 makes a modification to the Special Review Board and adds a psychologist to the qualified members of that are eligible to serve on the Special Review Board, and that psychologist would need to have forensics experience. Then Article 2 makes modifications to our state-operated services operating statutes. There are a number of operating statutes that were originally passed by the legislature in the 1950s that in today's day and age are really considered outdated. One of the examples that comes to mind is that we, in previous history, used to have staff that lived on the grounds of the campus of the old state hospitals, and there is a provision that's being repealed in Article 2 related to how we recouped rent and if housekeeping staff provided services to the living units of the staff who lived on the campus. That's an example of the types of things in Article 2. They're outdated types of provisions that no longer apply to how we operate as an organization, so our intent is to strike those provisions that no longer are relevant to how we operate as a system.
So Mr. Reuter, why don't you identify Section 1 of Article 2 is the data practices reference. Could you indicate the purpose of that provision?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Section 1 and Section 8 actually work in collaboration with one another. We have a governing statute on how we maintain and care for graves in the operating statutes for state-operated services. As many of you are aware, there has been an effort over the course of the last several years to place named markers with an individual's names on the grave. Presently, the grave is marked with a number that's considered the public welfare number. That number is a reference number to a list that is available for individuals who are buried in that grave. The Section 1 and Section 8 allow for the continued sharing of the person's name and date of birth and date of death so that the grave can be appropriately marked with a name. And then Article 3. Article 3 is a response of required by the department of what is commonly called the Jensen lawsuit. It was a settlement agreement that was reached related to how care and treatment was delivered to individuals at the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, which is a program that no longer exists. It has been changed into becoming a new program that provides care and services at Cambridge. That settlement agreement required that the Commissioner of Human Services go through statutes and identify archaic and outdated terminology that exists in statute. Examples of those terms are the words mentally defective, mentally deficient, persons who are insane, an alleged insane person, persons who are incompetent, inebriate, and handicapped, and retarded. So Article 3 is our best effort to find an appropriate replacement terminology to replace the terms that are identified in Article 3. Our intent, we had a work group that came together with a number of representatives from the Ombudsman's Office, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, Legal Aid, and Plaintiffs' Council, and others that came together this last summer and fall to look at these terms and what the appropriate replacement term would be. Our intent would not be to expand or contract how the term is applied within law so that we were expanding or contracting eligibility. And I believe, Mr. Chair, that is a very broad overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Reuter. got a note that John Kerwin in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office wanted to testify, and I know I've also had some inquiries from, well, maybe Mr. Kerwin will cover these, but I also had some inquiries from prosecutor's offices about some of the provisions here, and I don't know if there's anyone here who wants to testify to that fact or not. Mr. Kerwin, I've been waiting for the opportunity to have you in front of our committee.
At long last. Thank you.
You've been in the room for many meetings now.
Waiting for this moment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton. The two provisions, I'm here on behalf of my office, which is the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and also on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And the two provisions of the bill that I want to focus on are sections 18 and 19, which are on page 25 of the version that I have. And these are two provisions. Section 18 deals with, it sets the statutory standard for incompetence to stand trial in criminal cases and also for people who would be found not guilty by reason of mental illness. Section 19 concerns persons who are qualified or who may be disqualified from participating on a grand jury. And our concerns about the changes to those two sections are that while we completely understand and we agree with the need to change from the statutory language, which is antiquated and insensitive, that in deciding what new language to use, it really involves some level of policy decision. In addition to being antiquated, the old language was actually somewhat unclear, and so that to pick some new words, one has to decide what really ought the state's policy be on these two things. The language, by the way, in Section 18, even though it deals with both incompetence and criminal responsibility, the particular language that was changed deals only with the incompetence issue. But in that section of the statutes, we're concerned that by picking the new language, it may not mean exactly what the old language did, and more importantly, that in picking any new language, there needs to be some policy consideration to that. In Section 19, where it's...
Mr. Kerwin, are you recommending any particular change to Section 18 to accommodate those concerns?
We are not at this moment, Mr. Chair. These issues just came to our attention yesterday, and so among the county attorneys, we've really not had sufficient time to talk through among ourselves and with the other interested persons what language we think would be appropriate. We talked briefly with Senator Eaton in the hallway, and what I understood is that she's willing to consider suggestions that might be made before it comes up on the floor, but for today's purposes, wants to go ahead with the language in Section 18, and I think has suggested amendment for Section 19.
I guess I don't have that as the problem with this committee.
But while she's looking for that language, I would say what the county attorneys are indicating today is simply that this has just come to our attention. We have concerns about it. We want to be involved in discussions about, with all the interested people, in deciding what really is the right language, and that we want to indicate our willingness and intention to continue to work with Senator Eaton and others to make sure it may be that after careful consideration we'll decide this is the right language, or it might be that we would suggest some modifications to it.
Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to interrupt you, especially if it's been this long since you've been able to come up to the table, but I'm just thinking this language, particularly the issues that he's bringing up now, are probably issues that should be dealt with in Health and Human Service Policy Committee, and really don't have much to do with any kind of what this committee would normally handle, do they, Mr.
Senator
Chair?
Goodwin, this bill already came through Health, Human Services,
yeah,
and Housing, but the
Mr.
provisions
Chair?
That he's specifically addressing do relate to our jurisdictions. It's criminal responsibility and grand juries.
Oh. All right, so fine. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Mr. Chair, I would agree
Senator
with that.
Eaton.
I would agree with that. What I would like to do is offer an oral amendment on mine. It's page 26, 26.6, where it's crossed out is insane and add lacks mental capacity.
Okay. Okay, so you're looking at a different version than we have, Senator.
Okay.
You have the first engrossment?
Mr. Chair.
I think we're looking at page 25, line 33 would be the...
Okay.
Where clause 4 is insane is deleted?
Yes.
Okay.
25.33.
And what is your recommended replacement language?
Lacks mental capacity, Mr. Chair.
To make decisions.
Mr. Chair, we crossed it out and forgot to replace it.
It's better than nothing.
Okay.
I'm going to inquire of counsel. I'm kind of noodling over the language, too. Committee, jump in if you have any thoughts, but I'm just... This would be the grounds for an objection, right? And then a determination of whether there is, say, sufficient absence of mental capacity to disqualify the person from serving on the grand jury would be left up to the judge presiding over proceedings or some other decision maker.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of the basis for our discussion here, is that we're not sure any of this is the right language to replace this antiquated language. It hasn't been vetted, but we want to correct it before it gets to the floor. So I've been trying to decide how to go forward at this point.
But who would make the decision? Once there's an objection made, and I'm not sure if this is Senator Eaton's bailiwick or not, but once an objection is made to participation of an individual in a grand jury, who decides whether or not that objection should be granted?
Judge.
There's a judge presiding over a grand jury proceeding, is there not? Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that's so, but I'm looking for someone in the audience to help out there.
There's a prosecutor in the audience. Maybe you could answer. I haven't personally been through a grand jury proceeding. I can't say. Mr. Schweigert, do you know the answer from the County Attorney's Office?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I also have not been through a grand jury. My understanding, though, is that it has to be the judicial determination as to whether someone would be removed from their ability.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. So if someone else have something to add, come on forward if you want.
If you just want to know, I can answer the question.
Yeah, we'd like to know.
From the counties.
Identify yourself for the record, too, please.
Grand jury once. Chairman and member, my name
I had tunnel vision. I didn't know there was a judge.
I would like to consider kind of associated. The question is there a judge residing over the grand jury? Is that what you...
I guess that's the question, yeah.
I understand it's not in the jury room, obviously. Judge may be asked to deal with out of the grand jury, but there's not a judge sitting in the presiding over the
grand jury. I guess, are you clear the question is about a grand jury, not a pettit jury?
Grand jury. At least I've been in front of a grand jury before, and that was my experience in Rice County. Whether we do it wrong in Rice County, my county attorney is Paul Bowmaster, and
Oh.
Mr. Chair, might I address that?
Mr. Kerwin.
I was looking back through a string of emails on this, and I do find one from the chief criminal deputy from my office who says the decision on whether to remove someone always rests only with the judge, that the county attorney can make the objection, but it's the judge who makes the determination. I think the judge is not in the grand jury room, but there's a judge who's available to make such decisions.
Okay, so we don't have to be any more specific in the language except that the objection would be based that there's a lack of mental capacity and then a judge would make that determination.
It's my understanding.
Fair conclusion. Okay, any Senator Hall?
Senator Latz, is we're taking away insane. I would assume there's a definition for insane and it's a possible legal term. Are we transferring lack of mental capacity? Is that a legal term or is that subjective to what the judge decides that is?
Is it an adjudicated? Senator Hall, there is a recommended additional amendment. I don't know if you folks have seen it. Has A6 been shown to anyone besides me that would address that particular concern, which is to say that these are technical terminology changes and are not intended to be substantive. changes so that whatever body of case law is used to evaluate this stuff, that would be guidance to how to approach it. Senator Hall. And
Senator Latt, or Chairman Latz, thank you. Can I ask the reason for the change?
Senator Eaton or Mr. Reuter?
The reason for the change in terminology?
Yeah, from insane to lax mental capacity.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, the term mentally defective or deficient on line 25.20 was a specific term that was identified in the Jensen lawsuit as needing to be replaced.
Mr. Reuter, how about the term insane on line 33?
Insane as well. Insane was identified in the lawsuit as a term that needs to be replaced. And perhaps Mr. Kerwin can shine some light on his research that he's conducted quickly, but it's my understanding that the terms mentally deficient and the word insane, after a quick search, have not been defined in statutes.
Mr. Chair, I did last night. I didn't actually look for the word insane, but I did look at the annotations to section 611.026 to see if there had been any significant judicial definition of what the terms mentally ill and mentally deficient mean for the purposes of that particular statute. The word mentally deficient, by the way, is a term I think that pops up in a number of different contexts, and I think it's often used to, it historically has often been used to persons who would now be described as persons with developmental disabilities. But someone might look at that term and think it also suggests a broader meaning. I think perhaps the more important thing for the words terms mentally deficient and insane is that they're words that don't have a terribly precise meaning, and that if thoughtful people right now come up with a set of language that they think is more functional and will describe the particular disability that is attempting to be addressed, that there's just a level of, it's not simply replacing terms, it's making a policy decision about what that functional description ought to be going forward. And the point that I raise on behalf of the county attorneys is just that we simply did not address this issue or begin to address it until yesterday, and we haven't been able to give sufficient thought on a policy level as to what we think the appropriate terminology should be. And it may well be that when we do that, we won't have any significant disagreement with what's been done, or that we can, I'm assuming, can easily work out any issues that we do have.
So, Mr. Chair, I would propose the A6 amendment, which would give us a little comfort.
Right.
Okay, well, we still have the previous question about replacing is insane.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So let's, with your proposal to replace it with lax mental capacity.
Mr. Chair, can I make a suggestion? I think we might want to, by the time this gets to the floor, we can perhaps talk to where Senator Eaton can meet with people from the from NAMI and some of the mental health associations and so forth, because there are preferred terminologies that are used that are less abrasive, maybe even than this, but still get the point across. So I'd hate to see us put something in that's going to be antiquated as soon as it gets in. But at the same time, I think this bill needs to move to the floor because we need to get that derogatory language out of statute now, and language obviously messes up court cases, so we need to do that. So that's my suggestion, is that, you know, somebody work on this a little bit before this, and it'll probably be a while before this will get on the floor, and at least ask the associations what they're using.
Senator Goodwin, I agree with you, except that I think we ought to do our best in this committee anyway right now. Certainly there's flexibility on the floor to do any additional amendments if after those consultations or there's some additional suggestions. I will note to the committee members that on page 24, line 7 and 8, or line 7 in particular, the term lacking mental capacity is being used as some of the new language that's recommended to replace the term insane. So So, and counsel's advised me that's also present in about half a dozen places in the bill as well.
Chair.
Senator Loomer.
I noticed in the back of the bill there's a number, not the repealer section, but on page 26 and 27, there's a quite an extensive instruction to change all sorts of terms to different grammatical changes, headnotes, and other words similar to this. And we're kind of getting some testimony that maybe some of these terms are not necessarily what they should be. And I'm just not to denigrate the intent of the bill, but this was introduced 10 days ago.
Mr. Chair.
And we're now at the point of kind of jumping headlong into accepting definitions. And I'm not sure if this would make any changes to any case law impact or other areas of law, or is this covering everything in the statute?
I'm informed by counsel that none of the rules that are being corrected in Section 21 fall within the Judiciary Committee's purview. So,
all right.
I guess that would have been dealt with by Health and Human Services, presumably.
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe the point I was really trying to make is that I hope these changes have been presented with an appreciation for any other reference in law so that we may avoid a conflict of law sometime in the future with only 10 days of considering the bill. And this is the first time I've actually looked at it. And so I'm just a little cautious. It's usually this type of a scale isn't done quite this fast. And I'm just concerned about process.
Mr. Chair, I can maybe speak to some process questions. So the work group went through meticulously every statute where these terms were identified. And we attempted to look at the meaning of the word as it applied within that specific statute. When we came across a statute that was outside of the jurisdiction of the Department of Human Services, we attempted to contact the other agency or licensing board about the change that we were proposing to make. We received some feedback from some of those agencies and some of those boards, and we incorporated some of that feedback into there are two bills. There is this bill, and there is another bill that has been heard previously as well. So we've attempted to do some of the outreach. Unfortunately, we missed, apparently, the County Attorneys Association as we were proceeding with our work.
On this point, Senator Limmer, counsel's informed me that page 26, lines 18, 19, and 20 do address local jail facilities. Is that it?
Mr. Chairman, municipal jail facilities under Department of Corrections rules.
I will note that it appears that the corrections that are being made there are the same as corrections being made throughout that Section 21 revisor's instructions, meaning the replacement of the term retardation with developmental disability and so on. Let me make a suggestion, members, see what the committee thinks. I think we should just kind of do our best to come up with the language that we think works for the Judiciary Committee-related stuff. And then with the understanding that the County Attorneys Association is going to keep working and consult with NAMI and with the department to see if there are any additional corrections that might need to be made to the language for adjustment on the floor. Is that people comfortable with taking that approach? Okay. Then, regardless, take these one at a time then. For line 33 on page 25, Senator Eaton has requested that there be amendment to replace the deleted language before the semicolon, retain clause 4. So I guess how would we put this? We would remove the deletion of the parenthetical number 4 and of the semicolon. So they'll remain in effect. And then replace the deleted language is insane with lacks mental capacity. Did I state that accurately?
Mr. Okay. Members, yes. And then you'd have to do the renumbering on the next page as well.
Okay. Is there anyone who makes that motion?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer makes that motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Then there's the A6 amendment, which has been handed out, which relates to guidance to the courts in terms of construction of the language, that it intends to be technical and not substantive in change. Anyone willing to make the A6 amendment?
I will.
Senator Sharon raises her hand. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A6. Senator Eaton, are you okay with these changes?
I like it. Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you.
All those in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I have one more suggestion, members. On line, on page 25, lines 19 and 20, there's a proposal to delete mentally ill or mentally deficient, replace it with diagnosed with a mental illness or cognitive impairment. That seems to me to be a bit unwieldy in the way it's worded, and including for the reason that if there's no particular diagnosis that has been formally given at that point of time, then the defense or the incapability proceeding with the judicial proceedings would not be available. So what I would seek input on would be if we had it read instead, no person shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime while mentally ill or cognitively impaired.
No. Sorry, yeah. Mr.
Senator Goodwin.
While mentally ill is describing the person as a mental illness, so you might want to say people with mental illness, but not call them mentally ill.
Senator Goodwin, I understand because you've made that point
in
prior proceedings, but tell me if this addresses your concern, since the first two words on that sentence say no person. Then you can read it, no person while mentally ill.
With a mental illness.
With a mental illness?
Yes.
Senator Latz.
For any crime.
Senator Sharon.
I can see why that this is a problem. Because I wouldn't want to exclude somebody who has a diagnosis of a mental illness from simply because they have a mental illness, being exempt from certain proceedings. Oh, okay, but then it goes on to say, as long as it doesn't say that simply because you have a mental illness is treated often, and the person is functioning. They have the diagnosis, but it's treated. So the person is functioning. They are, even though they have a mental illness, they're perfectly capable of understanding proceedings.
But the sentence goes on, Senator Sharon, is a so as to be incapable of understanding the proceedings.
Yeah.
It's in the unamended.
Okay.
So while having a mental illness.
How about
if you try this, members? If it reads, no person while having a mental illness or cognitive impairment so as to be incapable of understanding the proceedings or making a defense shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, might I offer a comment?
Mr. Kerwin.
To be truthful with you, I also wondered why the phrase while mentally ill had to be changed. I understand that referring to a person as a mentally ill person is regarded as problematic, and we've attempted to move away from that language. But in other statutes, when the change was made to modernize language, for example, in the civil commitment law, category for committing people based on mental illness, the term was changed to person who is mentally ill. And I really, in line with your suggestion, I don't see while mentally ill as different than talking about someone who is mentally ill. It doesn't strike me that that's labeling a person.
I agree.
Yeah. Basically.
Mr. Chair, but your language does fit better.
Pardon me?
Your language does fit better.
Senator Goodwin.
I'll move that language.
So Senator Goodwin moves. I'll let counsel scribe it, but I'll repeat how it should read. No person, while having a mental illness or cognitive impairment so as to be incapable of understanding the proceedings or making a defense, shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime. Semicolon.
It says the same thing.
Seems to address. Committee's comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
Counsel, did you feel a need to describe it with a page and line insert?
Mr. Chair, would you just repeat it one more time slowly so we can just make sure we all have it as well?
Sure.
So no person,
then you're going to move, shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime, down two lines and insert it before the semicolon.
Fix it later.
You eliminate on line 20 the new language. let's see. While having a... Oh, actually, you don't have to. While having a... Okay, so here it is. So on line 19, delete, shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime. After while, insert having. Leave the remaining deleted language there, and on to line 20. With the new language on line 20, delete diagnosed with, and in its place, insert having. And on line 21, after defense, insert shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime. So it would read, no person, while having a mental illness or cognitive impairment, so as to be incapable of understanding the proceedings or making a defense, shall be tried, sentenced, or punished for any crime. Counsel, does that seem to work?
Mr. Chair, I think it does.
Okay. Any further discussion on this proposed amendment? Did someone move the amendment?
Yes, I did.
Senator Goodwin moves that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. It's adopted. Okay. Have we exhausted our Judiciary Committee jurisdiction here, Senator Eaton?
I'm kind of hoping so, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Anyone else in the room want to be heard?
I would just, Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask Mr. Kerwin if he's comfortable with that change, or is it digital health concerns?
Mr. Chair and Senator Disick, I think that the change that was made to Section 18 improves that and may be sufficient to satisfy the county attorney's concerns. We simply haven't had the opportunity to have that broader discussion, but I would be hopeful that after we have had it, we might be able to come back and say both of these provisions look fine to us.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, I can see where putting having a so as to impair is a little awkward grammatically, and maybe they'll look at it and they'll say mentally ill or cognitively impaired is a better replacement for that, but we'll let you guys work on that. Fair enough?
Yep.
All right. Any other discussion on Senate File 1297? Is there a motion? Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 1297, as amended, be recommended to pass and be... Where does this go, members? Senator Eaton, I've got
my understanding
a question mark
is
here.
The floor.
Floor of Finance. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, it's very nice of them to put in on line, page 26, line 7. Funding, everything in this article shall be administered within the limits of available appropriations. And any change in language does not expand or contract eligibility.
All right, so we skip finance, goes to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Welcome, Senator Eaton.
All right.
Okay, now Senator Goodwin.
Okay.
Senate File 443. Senator Goodwin, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 443 is basically trying to assure state employees that they're protected under the same whistleblower protections as other employees are. We have an amendment here. That would be the A3rd Amendment, and what I'd like to do is to put that on first and then explain the bill as it is amended, if that's okay. It's the A3 Amendment.
All right, so let's see here. Is this your first stop?
Yes. Oh, no, this is my second stop. State and local government heard it, too.
So please describe the A3 Amendment, please.
The A3 Amendment basically just defines a couple of terms that aren't clearly defined in law. And I am got an attorney here that I'd like to come up here and sit for comfort and maybe for helping me explain it, too. So it defines the good faith, it defines penalized, and it basically defines what a report means. So this will clarify some issues that have come up in court at different times that made the statute a little difficult to read. We're amending state statute 181.931, which is basically an employee statute, not just a state government statute. And you want to go ahead and explain this?
Go ahead and state your name, please.
My name is Larry Schaefer, members of the committee. I'm an attorney with the private bar, and I've been practicing for about as long as this statute has been on the books. And as the senator has mentioned, the definitional clarifications are necessary, and they are just that. They're clarifications. The clarifications are entirely consistent with the legislative intent of the Minnesota Whistleblowers Act. And more importantly, these clarifications are going to benefit both employers and employees subject to this law. And it's going to do that by defining in plain terms what these critical terms mean, what a report means under the law, what penalized means under the law, and what good faith is intended to mean as set forth in the statute. And what that's going to do is obviate the need for what has occurred over the past 25 years, and that's a lot of different judicial interpretations, a lot of fighting going on between both sides about the meaning of those terms, and it's going to provide much-needed clarity to both sides.
So, Mr. Chair, unless there's questions, I'll move the A3 Amendment.
I guess I have a question. Are there specific cases that have interpreted the terms penalized and reports on good faith that has led to this ambiguity? Or, Mr. Schaefer, is there in your experience as a practitioner that has been difficult to ascertain?
Yes, Chairman, there have been a number of interpretations, particularly on the issue of what constitutes good faith. And every time the courts have been forced to visit that issue at the appellate level, they have noted there has been no definition of that stated in the statute. So there is a judicial gloss in a number of different fact scenarios as to what that means, and the interpretations are all over the board. What this clarification here is intended to do is state that good faith means, in reference to an existing portion of the statute, it means that a report is not made with a reckless disregard to the facts or disregarding facts entirely. If a report satisfies that standard, it's held to mean under the statute that it's made in good faith. There is also, there's been quite a bit of different judicial glosses on what a report means. And the amendment is intended to clarify that in a way that's largely consistent with authority, but will ensure that there's not going to be a need in the future for a variety of different disputes between what a report may mean. And again, this clarification is consistent with the legislative intent of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. As to penalize, Chairman, there have been not the same amount of differing judicial interpretations of that, but what the amendment is proposing is a definition of penalize that's entirely consistent with recent United States Supreme Court precedent in the Burlington Northern versus White case, which basically holds, and that's in a retaliation context, that penalized or adverse action should mean anything that would dissuade an individual protected by the statute from going forward, coming forward, and making a report of a violation of law. So that amendment is entirely consistent with what the United States Supreme Court has held that should mean in a very similar context.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, these definitions that are before us, I just have to ask a question. I hope you don't mind. Are you a plaintiff's attorney?
Mr. Schaefer.
I am a plaintiff. My practice over the last 25 years has largely been in advocating for the employee side of those who are protected by the statute. I have done both, though. But in the context of advocating, that's been my focus.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Sir, would you think that a defense bar would agree with these same definitions and terms?
I think both sides would agree there's clarity that's needed. And I think the reason for that is to avoid having to hash out through the judiciary and burden the judiciary with competing interpretations of terms that ought to be made very plain in the statute.
The reason I say that, Mr. Senator Chair, Lumber. Is that these definitions, I don't know. I'm not sure, but could they give an advantage in a courtroom to someone and at the expense of the other side? I'm trying to determine that because what we do here is going to set the dance that you're going to have in a courtroom, and I don't know if there's a defense bar person here in the room that could give comment on this and would agree that this is purely a clarity issue and nothing more.
Well,
Senator,
in terms of just looking at these three different areas where the definition and the clarity is needed, I think that particularly when you look at what the legislative intent of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act has been, and has been really since 1987 when the law was enacted, the good faith component of what needs to be shown in making a report ought to be triggered by the language that's already in the statute, that you can't make a report that either disregards the facts or is in reckless disregard of the facts. I think that's a clear and necessary amendment to that language. In terms of what is a report, there has been decisions literally all over the map in different circumstances as to what that should be and how it should be applied to certain facts. My sense is that both sides of the bar would like clarity on what that is, and that's what these amendments seek to accomplish. And that clarity, I think the benefit of that will be the courts not being clogged with a bunch of motions and a bunch of arguments on either side as to what that means. Clarity helps, again, both employers subject to the obligations of this law and employees who are entitled to the protections of the law. And I think again, these particular provisions, I can't say to you that I'm certain the defense bar would agree with all the language there, but I'm certain they would agree there is a real need for that kind of clarity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, we'll ask if there's anyone in the room representing the defense bar that has any input on this. And they follow the bills that come through the process, as does anyone else. So if they had a grave objection, I assume they'd be present to voice it.
I would imagine. Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, on that point, could I ask counsel if she would, in the writing of this language, would you agree that this would be language that brings clarity in a neutral manner, not to give advantage to any party in a courtroom?
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yeah, I mean, on its face, it does look that. I will confess, I have not read the cases, so I don't know what the underlying issues have been in the case right. law. But
on face, it's.
On its face. It's
thank you.
Right, so, Senator Goodwin moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair,
who else is with you that would like to testify?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm a little slow on uptake here on the amendment. I thought I was reading somewhere about, here it is, on the amendment on line 1.15, it says a report is an electronic communication, says it's an employee about an actual, but then it goes into suspected or anticipated violation of a statute. So that's when we're talking about employees being able to whistleblow, which means create transparency, so further transparency about activity of their employer or their employee's organization, that they can write a report about something that has not yet happened or that they're afraid might happen or they're anticipating could happen. Is that what's being allowed with this language under report?
Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Senator, and I would like to address that because I think, again, part of the purpose of the act in the first place was to encourage employees to come forward and report illegalities in the workplace, whether actual current illegalities or perhaps equally importantly suspected illegalities or illegalities that may occur in the future and thereby maybe prevent that from happening or have a role in preventing that from happening. And that, you know, the law as currently drafted protects both individuals that refuse to violate the law, individuals that participate in investigative hearings on issues involving a violations of law, or who report violations of law. And that's what this language is intended to clarify by saying it doesn't necessarily just have to be something happening in the past, currently happening, but it's intended to also protect those individuals that are trying to get their employer to not go forward with a plan to violate the law. And that's, I think, what that intended purpose is. And again, that's entirely consistent with what I view the legislative intent behind the Minnesota Whistleblower Act to be all about. And I think by adding this group and the legislature is going to be assisting in some circumstances where employers may be prevented by courageous employees standing up from violating the law.
Senator Dziedzic.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm trying to think of an example, one that I can think of, and it might not be the best, but so you have an administrative assistant who is handling some of the books in the office or processes checks, and she's copying checks, and she knows what checks she's copied, and she, in her mind, she knows the checks she's copied and the amount they should be, and they're not showing up on the balance sheet, or she's not seeing them, but she's not in charge, and so she knows something's going on, she's not for sure what, and she's and there might be a point where she's anticipating, okay, he maybe hasn't cashed the checks yet, or he hasn't stolen money or siphoned money yet. He or she, the boss, hasn't taken money yet. But she's anticipating that's kind of what he's doing because stuff is just not adding up. And so I think that's the anticipated or the suspected. I mean, and quite frankly, in that case, if they don't say something, they could be considered liable or part of the criminal activity. So I think this covers some of those people, and in my mind that's what suspected or anticipated is, because they might not be the boss, but they kind of have an idea what's going on, and because they work for somebody who may be doing wrongdoing, if they don't step up and feel comfortable reporting to somebody, they could also be viewed as participating or an active participant. So
and Senator, I would agree that that's a scenario covered by this.
And Mr. Chair, I
Senator Goodman.
Senator Dziedzic, I can give a couple of examples of that, too, where employees have, state employees have come to me knowing that certain contractors don't comply with the contract that costs millions of dollars, or they're not getting it in on time. They're afraid that if they don't report that, even though the project may not be finished and they can't add it all up, that they will be then accused of violating the contract.
All right,
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
I'm just trying to understand this. I don't have the example that Senator Gooden gave just relates to an actual action that has taken place. Somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do under a contract, or didn't already has some violation of a contractual law, and they have the right to whistleblow that. But what Senator Dziedzic is saying is that there's if a person is worried that something might happen, that they're going to, and it does later happen, they might be drawn into the being accused as having been complicit in the crime because they didn't articulate or whistleblow on something that one could maybe logically say, if you saw this, it wouldn't be illogical to think that a crime might be committed in the future, right? But it also opens the door to suspicious or nervous or, you know, anti-antis, just sort of always saying that the motivations of people and what I'm seeing here is leading to somebody carrying out some illicit purpose, you know. So it's reporting something that somebody might do and requiring that person to somehow have to defend that they aren't going to do what they haven't done.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Sharon, I think that's highly unlikely because it's very difficult for employees to report things they know are wrong within their agency or their company or whatever, because whether or not they get direct problems out of it, they get indirect problems out of it. Nobody wants to lose their job over something that they falsely report or jump overboard on, and they can still find a way to fire you down the road somewhere without connecting it with retaliation. So people are very reluctant to give information that about illegalities going on.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
I don't want you to misconstrue what I'm saying, Senator. I do agree that there are many aspects of this that I like in terms of increasing the ability to protect and clarify the protections of persons who want to communicate what they've observed to have happened. Where I'm struggling a little bit is on the portion of it that relates to anticipated, if I anticipate somebody might do something wrong. That's the part that I'm having a little struggle with. But not with the idea of protecting persons from actually reporting, as it says earlier, they can dissuade a reasonable employee from making or supporting a report, including post-terminus, or somewhere in here you're describing where they have, they believe the truthful, accurate, is able to document, use documents and factual information to report something. I don't have any trouble with that. And I can be persuaded to not have trouble with the rest of it, but I am anxious about, just as in the civil commitment of sex offenders, where you're penalizing people through a civil commitment process for something that they might do in the future. It's wrong. So anything that's talking about what somebody might do in the future and having protecting somebody from making accusations about another person's for what they might do in the future, that's what I'm reading here under protections of a whistleblower.
Senator Dziedzic, you had your hand up as well.
Oh, I'm okay now.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Goodwin.
What if it's anticipated that in the securities and exchange business or whatever, an employee anticipates that the next move is going to be to sell some, you know, illegal securities or something, or move money in a way that it's not supposed to be moved, or put it into another company the way it's not supposed to be moved, and they have a pretty good idea that that's going to happen. They should be able to report to somebody without it meaning that they get fired. And that doesn't mean that if the employer is not intending to do that, there's going to be no punishment. If there's no evidence, there's going to be no punishment. So that's, you know, I think we need to be careful about removing that. If that's the only way I can get this through is to stop arguing about a word, then I'd say let's take the word out. But I think it's very important to describe those terms in statute.
Members, I think there are two streams of thought going here. One is a question about whether anticipated is appropriate in terms of kind of conduct that we want to be subject to the whistleblower statute. But the second question raised by Senator Limmer was whether or not the proposed language is simply a neutral description of existing law to provide some clarity, or whether it in some way changes the law substantively by expanding the protections in the whistleblower statute. The council and I have been taking a look at some of this, it seems that there is at least some question about whether some of the language here may expand the reach of the whistleblower law a little bit. The anticipated language is one provision, because if you look back to page one of the bill,
it's on there.
Line 11, 1.11, it refers to reporting a violation or suspected violation, but does not reference an anticipated violation. And then secondly, also in that line, it refers to of federal or state law or rule adopted pursuant thereto, whereas the definition report refers to statute, regulation, or common law. So it seems to expand it to common law as well. So I would submit that at least a policy question for this committee to consider is whether that
expansion,
that additional reference to anticipated, the additional reference to common law, is a direction that we think the whistleblower law ought to go. And then if it is, we may wish to consider placing those changes in a different location, particularly in Clause 1 of Subdivision 1 on Page 1, lines 10 to 12. Because it seems the definition of report in and of itself would apply more to the form of the report and by whom, rather than of what, which is really what's defined substantively in the prohibited action. Am I being clear? It all made sense to council here. So.
Mr. Chair.
Makes sense to anyone else? Senator Limmer.
I don't know if my line of questioning to find neutral clarity is in opposition or contrast to the concern of the word anticipated violation. I can see where we could easily step into that. I don't know if it's in direct contrast with what I was trying to build, but the word anticipated kind of takes it a step further, I think. But I could think of an example where, let's say there's an employee who has seen evidence of a misdoing or a wrongful act, and due to that knowledge would warn someone with a comment, and I know they're going to do it again on the next project. Let's take submaterial in the construction of a bridge or something like that. And if they had evidence that something was less than what it should be, they could make a, they could blurt out a statement, and I bet they'll do it again on the next project. Now, is that, does that fit the anticipated violation? Maybe it's a suspicion, but, and maybe the word anticipated is the wrong word, but maybe something a little more artful, I'm not sure, but I could see where a discussion in the process of whistleblowing could lead to that suspicion that it will happen in the immediate future.
Or even perhaps a report that hasn't been issued yet.
Right.
But it's expected to be. It's anticipating that it's going to be. And right. If it does, it's going to cause a violation. If you raise the issue before it's released,
yeah.
Does it cause, you don't want to be retaliated against for that.
Well, or does it become an accusation without, perhaps it doesn't have all the merit that it should have, but if past behavior is any indication of a future act, it may fall into a conversation. And I'm not necessarily sure that that in and of itself would be a wrongful statement as far as a whistleblowing context is concerned.
I guess the ultimate question would be whether or not, if one makes that statement that they're anticipating a future violation, should they be somehow penalized in their employment terms and conditions because they've said that? And we certainly don't want to create a workplace environment where they feel that they can't anticipate and report they anticipate something.
Senator Lass.
Senator Sherman.
Well, I think that what you were saying, that the separating out these terms about the content of the report from this report process is a good idea. And then going over here to page one, under prohibited action, and if you want to articulate in the same way that is in this amendment, that it ought to really go over on under prohibited action, as you were saying, as you articulated that if I understood you correct, that under the report it simply should be that it should be written, verbal, electronic, and or it should be described how the report is given, but what content is protected or what the content of the report is should be stated under prohibited action, where you're already saying a violation or suspected violation of any federal state law. If you want to expand it and articulate some of these other things, it should be done there. I agree with that. And then on the issue of whether or not it should be defined in this way, I understand the example that you gave, that you can protect the public from a terrible situation in the stock market if you're correct or if they know that somebody's looking over their shoulder. But I also know that that there's equally the problem of an administration having a very problematic ability to manage their employees who you can get a toxic group of people, you can get a lot of out-of-control behavior, creating a lot of problems for the administration by certain kinds of reporting. So on the one hand, you want to protect people who want to present information, but on the other hand, you want to not write something in such a way that employees can simply be reporting their administrative system all the time for suspected or anticipated activity, which the administration starts to become afraid of. And it really paralyzes the system from moving forward.
We have another testifier who wants to add to the discussion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney, legislative and political director for IBEW Minnesota State Council. One of the concerns that we've had is under anticipated violation or anticipated impropriety is inspectors being told that they should change their signed report. And this has happened a few years back in the Department of Labor and Industry in the OSHA section, where inspectors were told they had to change their report to suit the administration of that time. This could also happen in health inspectors, nursing home inspectors, other kind of inspections that go on where people have to sign their name to a report. They're putting their integrity on the line. And they should be protected from being told they have to change this report to suit whatever the boss's inclinations are. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haney.
Senator Latz. Well, I absolutely agree that if an employee is asked to do an illegal act, that they ought to be able to report that. I think that's an here and now illegal activity. That's not an anticipated one. That's one in which that has occurred. And I also think that that an employee ought to be able to report when a contractor is not paying prevailing wage. And I believe all of those things should be protected. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about anticipated. If somebody says to me, you need to sign a report even though it is not in compliance with the expectations, that is not anticipated. That is currently in existence that I've been asked to do an illegal act, and that's reportable and should be protected.
Senator Sharon, let me ask you analytically, how would you address the situation where an employee believes that a violation is about to occur? Should they be required to wait until the violation occurs before they make a report that protects them under the whistleblower statute? Or should they make the report before the violation actually occurs, not have the protection of the whistleblower statute, but be able to prevent the harm from occurring?
That is the dilemma. That's what I was trying to describe. That we could say that, and then people in legitimate situations like you described, Senator Goodwin, about the sale of securities or something, that has merit. I mean, we would all say, gee, we would like to prevent something bad from happening, and they should be protected. But the other side of that is that a person can, a group of employees can, be issuing all sorts of reports based on, in good faith, that I think that my employer is going to do bad things that have no merit to them. There are just a lot of complaints about my employer. That's the dilemma of this particular situation in my mind. I'd like to be able to allow for what you're describing without allowing wholesale complaints against an employer from disgruntled employees. I don't know how to accomplish both of those with language.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's Senator already Goodwin. In statute under subdivision 3 and page 181, or in statute 181.932, and that's false disclosures. And it says that the section does not permit any employee to make statements or disclosures knowing that they are false or that they are in reckless disregard of the truth. So that's pretty... I mean, they could get in lots of trouble if they did that. I'm not saying it's never going to happen, but we can't anticipate, you know, what all is going to happen. But let me just say this. I can bring my amendment back up for reconsideration. We can take the anticipated out. We can deal with that issue some other time if that would make people more comfortable. Let's get on with it because I'm sure people have other meetings and stuff today. But if that will make people more comfortable, I would be happy to do that.
What's the will of the committee? Senator Goodwin, you offered that amendment?
Offered that amendment. We voted on it, but I would offer it up for reconsideration to take that out, the anticipated part, and just put or suspected and then cross out or anticipated.
Okay. So Senator Goodwin moves to amend the language already adopted in the A3 amendment on line 15. After actual, delete the comma, insert or. After suspected, delete or anticipated.
Right. Or another option, here's something you can consider, is to put or planned instead of anticipated. I don't know if that makes anybody more comfortable to put planned in there, but doesn't make a difference. Then, I mean, if you still don't like that, then we'll take it out.
Since I'm the one that's saying, I think that the value of what you've recommended, Senator Goodwin, is that the bar is a little higher for having to prove that it was whatever that other thing is that you described, that they can be held accountable if they're just malicious. So planned, I think, makes it more difficult to be just complaining.
Right. That's true. It does. Okay.
Because they'd have to prove. They'd have to have something to show that it was planned.
Okay,
so that's Senator Goodwin, instead of her previous amendment, moves to
we'll just, Mr. Chair,
the word anticipated and
yes.
replace it with
planned. Yes.
All right. Any further discussion on this amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. All right.
Okay.
Ms. Thomas, were you working on any clarifications
in terms of
just how this all
Chairman,
fits together?
The only thing, I think if you look on the current law that appears on 1.11, you might want to make it parallel, reports a violation, where it says, or suspected, you'd want it to say violation, suspected violation, or planned violation. Get the planned concept in there as well in the operative language. So.
Okay, so Senator Goodwin moves
I'll move
to
that.
Line 1.11.
Right.
But to after the first violation, delete, or insert a comma, delete or.
I don't want to go through it.
Then after the second comma. Violation, insert or planned violation.
Correct.
Yeah.
Any further discussion of that amendment? Any further discussion of that amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
A little clarification. Did we actually vote for the A3 amendment already? Or
yes.
was it the amendment to the amendment?
Yes, we already adopted the A3.
Okay.
Thank you.
So this did.
All right. All those in favor of Senator Goodwin's motion to amend, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the only other question I had as Pontius was with regard to the term common law.
Yeah, because
where would you recommend that that be placed if that's
that
the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think, let's see here.
That's an expansion, too.
On line 1.11 again, after, I guess it's the first law, I put a comma. The sentence is getting longer and longer. And then on 1.12, after law, insert a comma. So, let's see. State law or common law. Yeah, that'll work too. Yeah, it works better. That's better, Mr. Chairman. So instead of the comma after that law in 1.1, just insert state law or common law.
Common law or rule.
Okay. So Senator Goodwin moves on line 1.11, after law, insert or common law. Everyone clear on that amendment proposal? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And then Senator Goodwin further moves that on the A3 amendment already adopted, line 16, delete the words. Let's see, line statute regulation.
And you can leave them there. Please, they're consistent.
Okay, well, that's fine. Then we don't have to make any change there.
Which you could.
Okay. I think it's all cleared up substantively.
Consistent.
It's consistent. Was there any further testimony, Senator Goodwin, that you'd like to offer on this bill?
A little bit, Mr. Chair.
It's your own risk, Senator Goodwin.
Okay, let's vote.
Okay, is there anyone else in the room that wants to be heard on this bill? Okay, please remember the testifiers. Please sign in when you're done. Anything to add to the conversation, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Kendall Killian from MAPIN. We support this bill.
Anything further? Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, now that we have the bill in front of us, the only question I have is, just in order to allow us to kind of go into this with eyes wide open, if we include legislators or a constitutional officer into the working definition of this area of law, I fear that we may run into easily politicizing
certain activities that have yet to be proven. And once you give it to a politician, you never know where it's going to go. And so I understand the need to have legislative policymakers understand what wrongdoing might occur in a department, but we're not judges. And I'm a little concerned that these types of things may get over-politicized, and who knows where it may go from that point. You know, we in the legislature have an authority given by the Constitution that if we wanted to, we could impeach a judge if the judge was neglectful or wrongful perpetually in his role of being a judge. We could do that, but we haven't done that. We've refused to take up that mantle. And I think it's because you would have every person that didn't like a verdict from a courtroom coming to the legislature wanting us to disbar a judge, simply because the person, the citizen, would feel like they were wronged by it. That would politicize the event. I don't think any legislator really wants to do that, but I do sense that we're kind of opening that door that some of these stories may be politicized without a trial. Well, so it's just an accusation.
I understand. Senator Mr. Chair, let me just say that the reason for this language being important is because already employees talk to their legislators about issues like this, and they are concerned about retaliation. And it depends on who the administration is, who the commissioner is, who the governor is, but there have been some that said absolutely do not talk to your legislators. So when we call and ask questions to departments, oftentimes we can't get the answer until it's been filtered through three or four or five layers, and how do we know we're getting the appropriate information? That's a concern. Again, I say that I don't think employees are going to come out often and come to us and cry about their jobs. They've got their unions usually to do that with, but so for the most part when they've come to me, and I don't know if people have come to you, I've had an awful lot come to me, and even within my district, state employees that come meet me at some restaurant where nobody will see them, so they can tell me that the department of such and such misappropriated a whole bunch of funds that should have been part of a special revenue fund for a certain thing. Well, so I have to be really careful because I don't want to expose that person, but at least I can ask some of the right questions in committee, or I can have the legislative auditor check up on it or something to that effect. So right now, if they do that, they aren't really protected to the same extent that private employees are. So that's what they're looking for. This bill has passed through the legislature twice, and almost unanimously both times. And two different governors vetoed it. This governor said he didn't like the first part, first section of this bill originally, and if we take that out, because that kind of sounded like it forced employees to report. We took that out, and he said he'd be okay with it if we took that out. So I think this has been an ongoing issue for like 13 years. It wasn't a partisan issue when it came before the legislature the last two times, not with the legislature, just with the administrations. So I really think that it's just the right thing to do. We don't want them to not report. Sometimes that's the way we get the best information on how to do our jobs and how to appropriate tax dollars most effectively or whatever, or, you know, to look into certain programs that aren't functioning well. That's why this is being brought forward, and I just hope that, you know, at least give them that assurance that if they talk to us or send us an email or something, you know, I hope that legislators and all the legislators I've known over the years would never spot that employee and make it, you know. I mean, I've never known somebody that was that unkind or whatever. But
it is 3:00, and we need to end the meeting here.
Okay, anything further I'm done talking. Can we please pass this bill? I'm making the motion. 443 as amended.
All right, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate file 443 as amended be recommended to pass. Once again, I have to ask because my notes are inconclusive. Does it go to the floor or to finance? Senator Goodwin, do you know if there's
Yeah, there's no fiscal note on this, so it would go to the floor.
And be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Members, it is now 3 o'clock. We have concluded our agenda for this afternoon. We are going to reconvene this evening. Given that we went over, and I know there are two committees that are scheduled to meet yet this afternoon until about 5:30, I'm going to suggest we plan to recess until 6:30. And that will also give council time to be prepared for this evening, and for those of us who are still here at other committees, time to get a good meal in. But I will ask, please be prompt at 6:30 so we can start right away instead of dribbling in 15 minutes later, since I'm given the extra time. Fair enough?
Yeah,
we'll be in this room, and the Judiciary Committee is in recess until 6:30 tonight. All right.